actually has a very rigid system in front, and the subsequently that we have a front clearing where we have systems coming to present, and there are now systems that we have. We felt that it would be very important for the department to come back to the committee to have the opportunity to also react to some of the issues, but also to share with us additional information in the end. We thought that we were going to ask the National Treasurer to be present today with us so that we can pursue some of the issues that were indicated in the last presentation as issues of either underfunding or non-allocation. I received a letter from the signed by Mr. Andrew Donaldson, Director General, National Treasury Action. And I just want to read for members so that we're all on the same page. Before, so that when the department interacts, we could also understand what the treasury response was. He said, "Thank you for your letter dated for May, in which you request that your committee be briefed on the processes underlying allocation of funds to the Foreign Affairs Board. You will recall that the Minister Manuel has on several occasions pointed to the important role of portfolio committees in association with the Joint Budget Committee in discussing and engaging with government future budget proposals as set out in the MTEF forward estimates each year. I am entirely in agreement that we need a common understanding of our foreign policy priorities and how these are supported through the allocation of resources. And we will greatly value an opportunity to meet with the portfolio committee. I need to advise, however, that I am puzzled by the example cited in your letter, which you state were outlined in the department's 205-206 annual report. We are not aware of any such outstanding matters, and in our view, there will be little value in reopening questions relating to the allocation. As I am sure you know, there are many hundreds of specific proposals tabled by departments amounting to between 2,000 and 200 and 300 billions of rand each year, and it is only possible to accommodate a limited number of these. Budget priorities are the responsibility of the Minister's Committee on the Budget and are informed by the deliberations of Parliament's Joint Budget Committee, and in particular by the hearings on the medium-term budget policy statement each year. My understanding is that over 1.6 billion was added to the Foreign Affairs Board in the 207 MTEF, and the department was fully aware of these recommendations when they were made to Cabinet as part of the budget proposal for this year. As is always the case, these recommendations accommodated some but not all of the department's requests. I have therefore requested that our budget examiner for the Foreign Affairs Board should meet with the department to clarify any misunderstanding that may have arisen. It will unfortunately not be possible for Treasury officials to attend the meeting proposed on 16 May, but we will welcome an opportunity to meet with the Portfolio Committee on a suitable occasion." I read this because I think there is indeed a misunderstanding. Our letter did not refer to 2005-2006 budget. We referred to 2006-2007 issues that were not funded, but some of them were carried over to this budget. However, because Treasury has a commitment to meet with us, I suspect that we may be having an opportunity at some point to interact with them, that we believe that there are other essential elements that they should have been considered in terms of allocation. But of course, the way the letter is written, it indicates the fact that they, on their side, they will be asking somebody to interact with the department to further discuss the issues. I took the liberty to raise the matter with the Minister of Foreign Affairs when we met, and we discussed the issues of the underfunding. And in fact, the view is that if we set up a foreign affairs policy and we don't fund it, we set ourselves to failure right from the beginning. And therefore, the funding of the department becomes a priority, and it becomes amongst the priorities that we need to look at as a country and say to ourselves, what is it that we need to do? and what is it that we cannot do. If you follow that argument, then you realize that one of the presenters raised the fact that we seem to be taking more than what we could be able to fund. That every time we take responsibilities, but we are not able to proportionally allocate resources to responsibilities that we take in the West. And that becomes an issue. So this is, that's how far we've gone in raising the issue of what we think is not adequate allocation. Allocation to the department. And of course, you always come across the question of the constraints in terms of the competing interests of government. But we think that as a portfolio committee, we need to argue strongly for a revaluation of that allocation, because there are critical areas that we think they need to have been considered. In the little allocation that's allocated, they should have considered certain aspects. We can debate others, but there are these that they should have actually been considered in that allocation. In that respect, DG, we are not going to go through a list of things that have been raised, but we are going to allow you to take us through in a form of a response. Where you want to respond to specific issues, you can take the liberty to do that. If you want to add other new things, you can take the liberty to do that. Thank you, DG.
Chairperson, thank you very much. And first of all, to once again record for the portfolio committee and register the fact that I'm really sorry that I was unable to come and explain to the chair to participate during the actual presentations of the different groups because of other commitments. But my colleagues were here, and I've just landed this morning, and we've tried as best we can to keep in touch so that one got a good sense of the issues that were raised. Fortunately, with some of the presentations, there were actual documents that were handed. So in addition to the capture and the recollection of my colleagues who were here, one had the benefit of looking through the questions. I must say overall, the impression that we got from the comments of my colleagues who were here, and also, as I say, just reflecting on those comments, is that these were, by and large, very constructive inputs. And I think the issues that were raised, whether in the form of questions or actual observations, were germane in our view. Now, say, the team has been here before, but right on the extreme right is Mr. Lubion Dimeni, who is in our multilateral branch. Next to him is Mr. Moodley, who is our head of our internal audit function. Next to him is Ms. Nombo Zolo, who heads our human resources portfolio. As you know, Ms. Jojozi is based here in Cape Town, and Tandi Fadan is our chief director on financial management. So that is the thing that is coming. I thought, Chair, the way we will run this, responding to this is first of all, indeed, not to attempt to comment on everything, because some of them were just valid observations, some of the issues that were raised. Indeed, some of them were raised by the members of the committee before, some of the observations, and we'll take them as far much more issues that that we need to follow up as a department. And then, of course, there are some issues that I thought we would try to respond to. And I thought, say, to put this in context, it might be important, one, just to reflect on the three major initiatives that the department has been participating in just over the past 7 days. Because actually they speak to the heart and they point to some of the major challenges facing our foreign policy, and in fact reflect the breadth and scope of our foreign policy. As you know, part of the reason we could not attend here is that on the 8th to the 10th of this month, we hosted the African ministers in Durban for a brainstorming session on the African agenda. And here we were trying to answer a number of questions. And central amongst them was a common understanding of the definition of where we are leading the continent to. And this discussion, which was in the form of a retreat, allowed the minister for 2 days
to reflect around, one, the common challenges that we face in the continent, two, the challenges, the real concrete challenges that face us as we try to advance the African agenda, particularly around the imperative need for greater integration in the continent. And the third issue was, which I think some of the questions, particularly those that relate to capacity, probably speak to, is sometimes how to mediate between the subjective feel that we have of what we would like to do and the objective conditions and objective factors and objective reality, which of course shapes the context and the backdrop for the execution of whatever else we want to do. I mean, this was the debate in the context of the continent. For example, one of the critical issues which does affect us in our execution of a foreign policy, we have to try, the foreign minister has to try and reflect on the challenge subjectively of the fact that generations of African leaders have always spoken about the imperative need for African integration in order to ensure that the continent occupies the proper place in the community of nations. But against that backdrop is the concrete reality of the preconditions for successful integration, the uneven nature of the development in the continent, and of course the tendency for countries in the continent to slide back to the comfort of their colonial past every time we're faced with difficult issues, which then leads us to raise the issue, is there something that is truly common that welds us together, that we can say constitute an objective basis for integration of the continent? So I'm raising this issue because these are part of the challenges that we are facing ourselves in the execution of foreign policy. I know that Chris Lansberg, in his input here, and Mr. Zondi made reference, for example, to the approaches that we should be taking towards countries like France in the context of the resolution or attending to problems in the continent. But that speaks exactly to that. It's something that is not unique for South Africa, but it's a challenge that all of us are trying to face as we try to shape and position and see how the continent can move forward. Now, that is one set of issues we've had to deal with over the past 7 days, and I'll come back as we discuss the African agenda to talk about how that relates to the issues that were raised here and how at least we see them from the perspective of the department. The second issue that we've had to attend to, which is what I'm coming from now, were two series of meetings in Brussels. One was the meeting between the African Union and the EU, the Troika of the African Union, in preparation for the AU-EU summit, which is now scheduled for the 8th and 9th of December in Lisbon this year. And there was really to confront the challenges around the need on the side of the continent. We have a far much more structured relationship with the European Union. Secondly, the need of the European Union to work with the continent, particularly to the extent that problems of the continent, whether in the form particularly of migration, which is a major problem in Europe now, have a tendency to flow on and affect negatively the countries of Europe. But also, more importantly, a response on the side of Europe, which is partly driven by the anxiety on the side of European powers because of what is perceived to be the encroachment of countries of the emerging powers of the East, in particular China and India, in what has traditionally been Europe's playing ground in effect. So that is the dynamic that was there. And again, I'm raising this issue because in the discussions, there are questions that are raised about how South Africa relates and articulates its own engagement with these emerging powers of the East. And of course, related to this EU-Africa discourse on Monday and yesterday, we had the opportunity for South Africa to sign a strategic partnership with the European Union, which is a further development of the relationship that we've had based on the TDCA. And at the heart of that strategic partnership is a common acceptance between South Africa and the EU that the relationship with South Africa, yes, has got a bilateral content, but it's got a far much more strategic content which relates to the recognition of the role that South Africa is playing, particularly in the context.
Now, how we play ourselves and make sure that we leverage that strategic partnership in support of the African agenda, but also not position ourselves in a very awkward situation in terms of how we are seen by the other African countries in terms of the special and unique relationship with Europe, is of course going to be a challenge for our foreign policy. And just to say to the members of the committee that strategic partnership was shaped in the context of also understanding that what Europe is doing is to have this strategic arrangement is what it considers to be strong regional power. As you know, that they've got such an arrangement with the U.S., with China, with Russia, with Japan, with India, with China, and also with Brazil. And so this was the addition of South Africa now to that list of countries. Now again, that forging of a strategic partnership speaks to a central element again, which I think there was recognition that South Africa is playing in the context of those inputs, which relates to how South Africa leverages its closeness or its ability to engage the powers of the North in advance to support the implementation of the African agenda, in addition, obviously, to our own bilateral national interests. I thought I should just make that because, in a strange sense, in my view, is that just over the past 7 days, we had the opportunity to just, in a very concrete and practical way, to have a tour to all the pertinent elements that characterize really the key elements of our foreign policy. And having said that, I will then go to the issues that were raised in the input. What we've tried to do with my colleagues is to try to structure this, just to give a set of structure to our input into broad categories, what was raised here. There were issues raised between the domestic goals and our foreign policy, issues around the African agenda, the issue of the South, and then we'll come back to flesh out some of the observations that we think were made that probably want to make comments on. North-South cooperation, the issues of global governance, bilateral relations which relate to the issue, are we overstressed? We have too many joint commissions or binational commissions. An issue that this committee has raised significantly, particularly during our last presentation here, which was our interface with the public. I see one of the presentations raised particularly the issue that we've had one in Bizo. And then we'll come back to that. Then there were issues, a series of issues that were raised which relate to DFA capacity. Sometimes raised as in the form of whether, in fact, the extent of our foreign policy, our own internal capacity is commensurate or is adequate to respond to those challenges of the extent and scope of our foreign policy. So those are broadly the broad categories through which we will try to run through. Now, as I said, some of these issues, I'm just going we will accept some of them because some of them are really comments that I think for us just to reflect in our ongoing work. There's the issue of measurement of our achievements. There's the issue of whether our international goals are pursued at the expense of our domestic needs. And then there's the issue of the definition of national interest. Now, the broad comments I would really like to make here on this set of issues is that I think we are struggling a bit. For example, let me start with the issue of relating our foreign policy initiatives to our broader domestic challenges. I think this relates to the issue of communication because actually, Foreign Affairs derives its mandate in terms of our work from the Media Strategic Plan of Government, what is called MPSF now, the Strategic Framework. And the Strategic Framework that guides government now has defined the central task for government as growing the economy and making sure that that growing economy addresses the issues of poverty and underdevelopment on one side, through greater job creation on the other side. Now, and this has informed the emphasis that Foreign Affairs is beginning to put on the issue of economic diplomacy. Now,
So the question we have to ask ourselves is that in the context of that, what is it that foreign affairs should be doing? Related to that, I think there have been genuine questions that were raised or comments that were made during this presentation about the extent to which the preparation of our diplomats is equal to that task and those challenges of economic diplomacy. And let me say, I think we would be lying if we said we are exactly equal to that task. I think that's work in progress, and there are a number of initiatives that we'll come back to, which relate to our interaction with the DTI, curricula changes, and also the recruitment drive that we're having in the department, that particular targets now people who've got greater understanding on economic issues into the Department of Foreign Affairs. Now, again, how we then make sure that, because in reality, even though the Department of Trade and Industry has probably about 20 countries where they've got trade officials, in reality, most of the most focal points for interaction between people interested in investment in South Africa and the South African government is through the missions of foreign affairs. That is why it is important indeed as a critical issue that people working there must also be able to respond to that. Now, I think it links to the bigger problem that you raised, that probably those linkages we are not communicating properly to the public. I think they may be shaping and informing the way we are doing things in the department. But again, I think that's a point that we considered in the last meeting. And I think in our business plan for this year, for 2007-2008, we have built in, again, probably about 3 or 4 settings of those engagements in the form of Invisa and the provincial, in the provinces. The issue of the national interest of South Africa, there are questions that, and I think one of the presenters alluded to that, but it's a question I must confess occupies us also in the context of the IRPS plan. Crudely put, or where it gets its crudest manifestation, is when we have to deal with the issue where people say, but South Africa, you are committing so much of resources to promote peace in the continent, but the beneficiaries of that stability are everybody but South African entities. Now, the way we are, and of course people trying to raise the issue of how we should be better synergizing with the South African business in terms of looking at opportunities in the continent and things like those, I think our approach to this is driven by, and here I again, it's one of those things all I can do is to share, certainly from the perspective of us looking at it from the Department of Foreign Affairs and our understanding of our brief. The first thing is that we argue that if we come back to the central challenge of South Africa, we want to grow the South African economy. If we want to grow the South African economy on a sustainable basis, it is not possible to do that in the context where we carry so much of a deficit because of the neighborhood where we are located. And so the issues of peace and stability in the continent and in the region directly feed, have a bearing on the attainment of our fundamental objectives. Even before you talk about anything else, from a point of perception, from a point of perception of investors, and also from a point of perception and understanding of probably markets that have got potential as major investors begin to look at options. For example, what would make an investor to come to South Africa if South Africa is competing with Brazil and with India? And you look at the market sizes of these three entities. South Africa starts at a significant disadvantage. But of course, South Africa, in the context of a stable region, growing economies in SADC, when we talk about a population of 220 million, of course begins to start on a completely different platform and becomes very far much more attractive for those investments. So, as an objective fact, for us, we start from that basis. Then, indeed, there is the other reality, which is that South African businesses, for South Africa, is already amongst the top 3 direct investors in the continent as we stand now. Now, all of us know, and I think within those presentations it has been clear, that this is a mixed picture because in certain instances, some of the businesses do things that undermine our foreign policy. And again, I think this committee has raised that concern. We are in discussion with DTI. We've started engaging business. For example, there's a forum that we work with sitting here now, DTI presidency and ourselves, together with some of the business schools, where we are particularly looking at the investment in the continent. And we're not just looking at the conduct of South African business, because we thought that we should broaden the scope. We're looking at South Africa's business investment, but in addition, we're looking at other major competitors to South African business. In particular, for example, we reflected on China the other time. And we are trying to pool people, the insights of researchers, academics, and we've called in top business people. Just 2 weeks ago, the focus was actually trying to look at the DRC. And we invited South African companies like Vodacom, who are investing in the DRC, to share their experience so that our own understanding and the formulation of our perspectives on this is shared by that. So I think, Chair, I really want to say on this sort of issue, I think we have a lot of work in progress. I think it's not an easy area. It's not an easy area, also quite frankly, because we are talking about the national interest, and we're making a presumption that national interest is equally shared. And when it comes to projecting and marketing South Africa, we know there's only this amount that governments do, because the interaction with business, with the critical stakeholders, happens across the spectrum of organs of civil society. Business people are very important. Academics are very important. And part of what we are working on as a project in the IFPS cluster now, which we are expected to present in the next quarter, is to formulate a strategic framework for South Africa's external projection or marketing of South Africa. On the 4th of June, we are bringing together all the marketing entities in the provinces, all the national marketing entities, all the international relations, the units of the provinces, because, and also some key stakeholders, parastatals, and some of the major businesses. Because part of what you need to understand first is then to have just a common understanding of what it is that in South Africa we believe are the things that give South Africa comparative advantage. Which all of us, if you listen to the Chinese, it doesn't matter what element of the Chinese that you get or meet. There are certain 4 or 5 things that they will make sure it's like a poem that is being recited. What are those 4 or 5 things in South Africa that all of us actually say we put on the table? So I'm just saying the complexity around this relates principally to that, but I think this is an important issue which I think the colleagues who made input here, there are some suggestions that they made, and I think we'll take those suggestions into consideration. On the African agenda, there's the issue of financial resources, strengthening of the organs, the secondment of South Africans, who our strategic partners are. In this retreat of foreign ministers, if I may share this with the committee, one of the issues, and I think it was put in a very, very provocative and very direct sense, by the chair of the commission. And he posed the question, is Africa ready to accept that in the continent, yes, all of us may be 54 sovereign states, but any region of the world that has developed tends to build around key locomotives of that particular region. Is Africa ready to expect and accept that there will be countries in Africa like South Africa that every time they take a move, it should not always be seen in a negative way, should not be seen as a manifestation of domination, but an acceptance of the fact that the development of the region, of the continent, at the end of the day is going to be driven from a number of centers, but not by all 54 countries at the same time. Now, as you know, this has been a major challenge of our foreign policy, how to make sure that we contribute, we play a leadership role, but we are not misunderstood. Now, you talk to different South Africans, you've got different perceptions. Some people think the government or our foreign policy is too cautious. Others are pleading for more caution. Now, I think it's a balance that we'll have to try to exercise as we move on a day-to-day basis, because either way, if you overplay one side at the expense of the other, of course there are risks in that. Related to that,
this question was posed in the festival when there was a discussion around funding for the AU. And we can say without any fear of contradiction, one of the best equipped resource institutions of the AU as we speak today is the Pan-African Parliament. And the Pan-African Parliament has facilities that no other organ of the AU has. And it's largely because of really South Africa honoring every element of the undertaking that we have made. Now, we are now in the stage where we're moving on and getting an international competition to build the permanent seat of the Pan-African Parliament. Again, we will do that long before other organs of the AU have been put in a similar situation. When there was a discussion around the funding of the AU, there were some people who proposed that the funding of different countries on the AU budget must be commensurate to their contribution to the GDP of the continent. That, by definition, would have meant that South Africa should contribute 22% of the budget of the AU. Before South Africa could pronounce on that, before South Africa could pronounce and do our own internal consultation, that discussion was aborted halfway because a number of countries raised concern that they do not want to have the budget of the AU over-dependent on one country. Hence, we came to the formula of 15% contribution for each of the five major economies in the continent. Now, again, the chair of the AU was raising a principled issue. What does it mean when you do not want to approach countries of the continent and simultaneously you are going to the major powers of the world to beg for money? Is that what is going to promote integration in the continent? So the point again I'm raising is, all of us know the AU is facing major funding problems. South Africa, I think on our side, we've done what we have to do. We pay our dues well in advance. We are ready to support specific projects of the AU. For example, this year, we will be more or less contributing to the hosting of PAL here in South Africa. Everything that we've been asked to do, we try to make our contribution. But I think, again, we have to play, we're playing it cautious and understanding that there are certain sensitivities which largely derive under this fear of. If anybody were to ask us, is the budget of the AU adequate to the task? Of course not. The budget of the AU, as we speak now, is $164 million. It's a fraction of the budget of the Department of Foreign Affairs. And it's supposed to deal with all the complex issues in the continent. Of that $164 million, only half that amount is actually contributed by member states. The other is money that depends on donor funding. Now, does South Africa think that that budget should be increased? Of course we think it has to. Is South Africa succeeding in pushing that? Of course we are failing. And the reason we are failing to argue for that is because all the other countries are arguing that they cannot afford to make a greater contribution. And at the same time are arguing that they do not want one particular country to go. So we caught up in a very difficult situation. And that affects then the power, the ability to do things within the organs of the AU. Now, so what we then end up doing is then to support, as I say, for example, in addition to our general contribution, we're now supporting, for example, the Commission on People and Human Rights. We are funding a lot of their activities because we think it's an important thing for them to do. We've now been asked, for example, to fund other projects within that we think that the continent is important, but of course we believe it's important for the continent to mobilize the resources to fund those. And that also speaks to the problem that was raised on a number, and I know that the committee has raised, and then that will repeat the issue again, which is around then the secondment of South Africans in this organ. The truth of the matter, up to now, we face the problem that there is no South African at a particular level, director, chief director, who will go to the AU, because actually they lose significance. And this is linked again to this funding structure. It is linked to the remuneration level. Until, of course, towards the end of last year, when a decision was taken that now we are going to second people. Essentially, then the employees of the South African government and the DPSA and the Treasury have now approved that. I think it was around November last year.
for us to then second people. And of course, what that has opened up significantly, people will continue to contribute to their pension funds here to the South African government. They will still be employed by the South. They will get their salaries in South Africa. And then all that international, whether it's SADC or AU, will deal with the additional costs that relate to relocation of families and the fact that people will be in a foreign place. And that is what the government is then trying to do to improve. Of course, you then get into other very difficult issues that to deny is also self-defeating. Because if you go to Addis, you are not going to get facilities for education that are comparable to South Africa. When you go to Addis, you are not going to get healthcare facilities that are comparable to South Africa. And remember, all these factors have in the real world, have a bearing on the decision that individuals take, especially because we are treating the issue of secondment as a voluntary issue. We have not taken a policy decision that individuals, as part of their employment, would have to rotate and probably be placed in that. And the problems that government is confronting now are not different from the problems that the Department of Foreign Affairs faces every time we take a decision to open a mission in Chad, and we have to deal with the reality that we have to place officials there. Most of the officials who go there leave their families behind because of the facilities in some of these cases. So I think those are some of the difficulties that I thought I should just highlight on this. Now, I think when it comes to the agenda of the AU, far much more broadly, apart from some of these issues that I've alluded to, I think we're comfortable because the agenda of the AU, I think, is very consistent with the agenda that we are trying to pursue ourselves. And that is why, by and large, there are areas where there are slight divergences. There are areas where we think, maybe I'll come to that when I come to this issue of the vote in the UN. But maybe just to say, remember also that in terms of our own articulation of our position, especially when we get into the multilateral format, we always have to, and this is increasingly becoming a sub issue. We get criticized on positions that Africa is taking, for example, on Darfur within the Human Rights Council in Geneva. And it's a very difficult issue. South Africa, we are committed multilaterally. Always a delicate balance on what point where we have policy positions in our own country, in our own constitution, which puts us in a far much more advanced position compared to other countries in the continent. How do we make sure that we pull people forward, especially, let's say the issues debate around human rights, but at the same time understand that our strength also derives from the fact that we work as part of the African continent. And it's not always an easy thing, and I think we'll come back to it. The issue here, I thought I wanted to discuss the two issues because, again, some of these issues we've spoken about. I think just to say the issue of Western Sahara was raised during our discussion and we made certain commitments. You will know that actually South Africa tried very hard in the context of the current discussion that is led by the Security Council following the resolution on Western Sahara. Tried very hard to make sure that resolution was balanced. I myself hosted here as part of the preparation for that, my counterpart from Algeria. And as I say, we tried to make sure that the resolution that emanates from the Security Council at least is not too much biased in favor of Morocco, which was actually the case with the Fed. So that as we promote dialogue between Morocco in line with that resolution, with the deadline of June that has been given, at least Western Sahara starts from a position of feeling the support and the previous UN resolutions that have been there. So that is work in progress. I think it's going to be a very difficult issue. We've experienced over the past few months greater feeling of anger and bitterness on the side of Morocco towards South Africa because of the positions that we're taking. But that's something that we are trying to manage as we move on. The issue of belonging to two regional economic bodies. Maybe just to say that South Africa, we have struggled to arrive at a common position that is shared by finance, DTI, and foreign affairs. And
as a common platform for government. But I think we have arrived at that position now, sometime probably clearly articulated last year. And that informed the input of our president during the special session that was in October here in South Africa, summit looking at regional integration. The essence of that approach is that we have got SADC and we've got SACRO. That our final commitment is to establish a customs union that is SADC-wide. That is why we've also a signature to the decision that a full SADC-wide FTA must be established in 2008. But what we have said is that the establishment of a customs unit must build on the strength of the experience that exists in the region. And part of that strength and that experience is actually the experience around regional establishment of a union that is embodied within SACRO. So our position is that we will move towards a SADC-wide union, but building and consolidating and taking the correct experiences from SACRO. So we do not see currently a basis for the dismembering of SACRO, because we believe SACRO is a very good foundation for a SADC-wide union. But we also do not think that the issue would even arise, because once there's a SADC-wide union, then SACRO ceases to exist by definition, because then all the members of SADC and all the members of SACRO. And in any event, the WTO would not allow any country to belong to two customs unions at the same time. The issue now is that that customs union in SADC does not exist. There's a date of 2010, but we know that the likelihood is that customs unit is probably going to be attainable by 2012 or 2013, looking at just the practical work that needs to be established. And that is why South Africa is supportive currently of the move to incrementally expand SACRO with the addition of Mozambique, for example. I know that Angola was also trying to look at SACRO, and we think that might not be a bad idea to expand SACRO. And as you do that, actually you increase the number of countries that already meet the requirements for belonging to a customs union. At least that is how we are trying to relate this. As I say, probably a full finalization of our own position became clearer some time last year. And we have to go through a debate as some people argue that it is not going to be practical to have a SADC-wide customs union, because of the significant disparity in the economy. And other people are saying, let's rather look for a SACRO plus type of arrangement. And the final argument that won the day, which we believe politically is correct, is that there has to be an alignment between what we look at from the perspective of economic integration with what we are looking at from the perspective of political integration. We can't at one point talk about SADC and the southern region of the Africa region as the platform for regional integration, and then want to define a different entity for economic union. So that is the basis. And that is the argument that we are communicating to all our negotiating partners, particularly the EU. The issues around the consolidation of regional democracy in Swaziland, consolidation, I think we discussed this when we spoke in the committee. Because I've just left these things up as they didn't come up from the discussion with the presenter. On the issue of strategic partners with respect to the South-South agenda, let me start with the issue of whether there's a contradiction. This is second last bullet, it's duplicating IFSA when we have bilateral arrangements with India and China, or India and Brazil. In some of the discussions we had with other departments as we were working on IFSA, this question kept on arising. But it was resolved by experience. And that experience is that the truth of the matter, there are things that Brazil wants to do with South Africa but does not want to put into the trilateral arrangement. And there are things that India is comfortable with doing with South Africa, does not want to put into the trilateral arrangement. And in any event, the argument was that we cannot take everything and put it into the IFSA trilateral. The things that should be done on a trilateral basis must be things where there's value added because they are done at that level. But that should not replace the bilateral arrangements that each of the countries have.
So in our sense, I think in any event, we believe that by strengthening those bilateral arrangements, we're finding by concrete experience again that it sets a better platform for identifying and agreeing on things that you want to pull out now to a far much more strategic and at a bilateral level. There are things that, of course, where we have less of bilateral but more of trilateral, but those tend to be the issues around trade negotiations. But even there, in terms of multilateral, but even there, for example, if you take issues of environment, South Africa and Brazil probably have got similar perspectives compared to India. So if we try to formulate an ISA position, it's as difficult as going to any other multilateral forum. But of course, we're trying to work through some of those difficulties on an ongoing basis. The point I thought I needed to just talk through a bit was an issue that I just got a nagging feeling that reading through the presentations and hearing, looking at the notes that our colleagues made, that there's a sense that our strategy with respect to the East is confused, it's not clear, and I do not understand what that is. I think we basically can look at the countries in the East and look at basically three categories. We've got countries that are our strategic partners, countries that we're engaging with both with respect to a bilateral agenda, political, economic, scientific, but also with respect to the fact that we think those are major players in the continent. And we've agreed in our arrangements that in addition to discussing bilateral issues, we must discuss continental issues. That is the approach we're taking to India and China, for example. China, there's a very clear understanding that every engagement we have with China, we must also talk about continental affairs. Then there are countries where we interact on a bilateral basis, but we also interact with them because they are very influential countries within the NAM or the G77. And also the countries like Malaysia, for example, and like Indonesia, and also because of their influence in the Islamic world. Then we've got countries in the South, and I would dispute, I see that one of the inputs suggested that to create some sense of vagueness in terms of our relationship with South Korea. And we would dispute that, because South Korea and Japan fall to a completely different category, where political issues are not major issues in our engagement. They are there, but the major issues that we're dealing with them are economic issues. And that is why if you look at the volumes of trade between us and Japan, if you just scrutinize the content of the visit of the deputy president just recently to South Korea and look at what is it that was actually discussed, what shaped the program, who did his visit, what entities were engaged with it, you will see a very clear slant which is far much more economic in our interaction with South Korea. So I think that is the way, and for us, I think one of the major achievements we would argue of democratic South Africa, it's just that I was trying to think about the figures and I couldn't get them before I came to this, because I think I will send them to the committee. Because it would be very instructive to look at our volumes of trade with the major powers of the East and compare 1994 to now. And you will see the significant impact of the diversification of the South African economy. And I think that to us is very important on that field. But also, I think, given that the relations with China are only 10 years old, I think there's been a significant improvement in those political considerations. Now, who are our strategic partners in the South? I think India and Brazil are clear, and I've already alluded to China. But I don't think that's an exhaustive list. There are many countries that are trying to develop strategic relations on. For example, we have now set up the importance that we are attaching to Argentina because of what we're seeing in the economy and the growing influence of Argentina as it recovers from the economic crisis that it has. It is quite clear to us that we must build on the interaction that we are having, because all of us are invited into the outreach of the G8 with Mexico. And that is the clear brief that is given to our team that has gone to Mexico now. We are also trying to understand
and interest far much more closer. I'm not saying that necessarily why the level of established strategic partnerships, but we're trying to understand also far much better what other countries in South America like Venezuela, and again, that informs the interaction that we're beginning to have with them and the fact that Chavez will be coming here in the second half of the year. So I think we are trying to open up, and of course there are other countries like Malaysia, as I've indicated, with Indonesia, where we are having far much more broader, wide-ranging type of relationships. I spoke a bit to this North-South cooperation at the beginning, but maybe just to emphasize the fact that when it comes to France, in the January cabinet, we made the point that one of the experiences that we've had now is that we must really engage far much more proactively some of these countries that are active in the continent. And we cited France as an example. But of course, we are also trying to understand that the dominant view in Europe now is that we might see a France that, although it continues to focus on the continent, but however, it might far much more be pursued because Sarkozy's inclination is far much more to develop what is called the Euro-Mediterranean region. And I think there's a growing view on that from Spain and a growing view from Portugal, which of course is going to have the effect of reinforcing the Barcelona process and the countries, particularly the so-called Arab countries in the north, and linking them far much more greatly to South and to Mediterranean Europe. That might have its own implications for Africa. Remember that when it comes to issues like Western Sahara, Côte d'Ivoire, what we saw in French foreign policy, we saw a combination of both general French policy, but also a strong imprint of President Chirac. And to what extent some of those elements are going to be there and what form they will play, I think it's something that we'll have to observe as we move on. Indeed, I think the point that in our presentations we have not given much focus, we have not spoken a lot about AGOA, I think it's valid. The strategic partnership with the EU, as that tries to indicate, I think to us, I think it's an open thing. The EU has got certain interests, we've got certain interests. I think it's only time is going to tell whether, in fact, we're able to play this as well as we should or as we wish to. And I think to us, the important thing is that we want to consolidate the EU, still remains our major trading partner. We need to consolidate in that. I think the EU, working together with us, can play a very critical supportive role to our own African agenda, particularly because there are a significant number of values that are shared. Thirdly, I think we can use our position, and we have begun to do that. I think it's quite clear that we can do that to make sure that we influence the way, the attitude, the approaches that are taken, particularly with respect to the continent. For example, I mean, even this discussion now about the how we should approach the Lisbon meeting. I mean, the Lisbon meeting, how to make sure that, how do we select issues that we should be putting on our agenda. I think these are things that have been going on bounce one way or the other in our interaction with the EU over the past. That is why we are perfectly comfortable now with the approach, and we believe not just for South Africa's interest, but also in terms of advancing the African agenda. Maybe I should just say something about NEPAD, because it's an issue that has come out again, and maybe just to re-emphasize the point that I've raised before. Because I think we have to accept that we have some challenges with respect to NEPAD. I think the question is easier to pose about what it is that South Africa is doing about NEPAD now, easier to pose than actually define very clearly what it is that we should do. And the reason is that, I mean, we cannot run away from the fact that there's a challenge with respect to NEPAD now as we speak.
The first one is that once we move beyond the conceptual into the implementation, we need strong organs to implement that. And currently, the existing instruments are weak. The second issue is that, much as we would not want to overplay that, the transition from Professor Nkosi to the next group of management of CEO has not been smooth. And we all know that there have been some dynamics that are hidden, that are trying, that have been playing themselves out in that transition. And you add to that the fact that there has been a very contradictory and ambivalent approach towards handling the implementation of the decision of Maputo of 2003 about the migration of NEPAD fully into the AU structure. And even after the decision, the African leadership itself has been very not clear about what that decision in reality means. Particularly for the simple reason that people at one point want NEPAD to be integrated into the AU, but at the same time people are concerned that given the difficulties and some of the dysfunctionalities to an extent within the AU linked to resource constraints, that we should not also subject NEPAD to that problem. So to try and strike a proper balance, and this is, of course, to try and work around all those concerns has been difficult. But at least we are, and of course we all know that there's always been the issues around the differences in the philosophical approach to NEPAD. That was there at the beginning, have kept on resurfacing. And resurfacing, particularly the more there is difficulty with showing visible results around viable projects, and we move back into that. Which is why early this year, the leadership, I think correctly, decided to have a retreat in Algiers to try and actually say there's a confusion, we have to accept it, and let's try to see how we rescue this process and move it forward. And our hope is that the decisions that were taken there, which are now being implemented, will assist in that process, including clarifying what is meant by this movement of NEPAD into the AU, which I think now at least we're in a better position to deal with. So that's why I say the issue of NEPAD for us has also been very sensitive, because hidden in some of the issues has been the fact that the truth of the matter, NEPAD gets a transfer from the Department of Foreign Affairs of 30 million rand a year. Therefore, the viability of NEPAD in terms of its base infrastructure largely depends on that support. But it's been a very sensitive issue for us to engage how we maintain that viability of NEPAD and also deal with the sensitivity that inadvertently gets created that keeps on linking NEPAD as a South African idea. So that is the effect of the matter. So how to manage and navigate through that as we try to move forward, of course, it's not an easy thing, especially given the position that we're in ourselves as South Africans. But as I say, I think the decisions that were taken in Algiers now help us to try to move forward better on this issue. I think the issue about focusing on MDGs, I think, is at the heart of our program. I think virtually our own characterization and as part of the developing world, how we influence the final outcome, for example, of the global consensus that emerged in Kofi Annan's document of the high-level panel that began to establish some sort of equal importance to the challenges of development, promotion of human rights, and issues of security, when in fact we know that at the beginning of that debate, the developed world was far much more elevating the issues of security. And part of the underlying philosophy for us was exactly this, maintaining and making sure that this development agenda around the MDGs is. And I think there is no specific intervention, there's a multiplicity of interventions that South Africa is involved in to try and impact positively on the attainment of the MDGs. And part of that relates, whether it's in the trade negotiations, where it's around the debt rescheduling, whether it's about the reform of the Bretton Woods institution, or actually far much more the discussion about aid in the continent and how the aid flow should be managed. All those have a bearing on that.
Yes, we agree with the general thrust of the input that yes, indeed, there's a problem around the issue of terrorism. But I think South Africa's position has been consistent and very clear on this. One, we are opposed to any form, and we believe that there is nothing, no court can justify terrorist activities as a starting point. Secondly, we always are there in the front line of the forces that meet their obligations in terms of their responses, legislative amendments to support the fight against terrorism. But we're also amongst the forces that are very insistent that in the battle against terrorism, let us not undermine international law and the promotion of human rights. And of course, the last pillar of our discussion on the issue of terrorism has been around clear separation between terrorism or labels of terrorism and the legitimate struggles of people for self-determination or people against colonial rule, and including the recognition of the entity or the existence of the entity of state terrorism. So I think that is what we agree that there are difficulties with around terrorism, and part of the difficulty now is around this issue of state terrorism and to a large extent how to accommodate this issue of legitimate struggles for self-determination. But I think on our side, at the level of practice, I think we are doing what we have to do. The issue of our involvement in the Security Council, Chairperson, if you may allow, I think we've actually probably either Deputy Minister Aziz Fahad or the Minister will be approaching the committee, because we have taken a decision that probably there should be a far much more robust discussion around this issue of our experiences in the Security Council at the Parliament level. Because we are getting a bit anxious that that at the level of practice, that we don't seem as a country to know which balance we want in terms of there are principles that we need to defend, but some of those principles are not popular. So we can't use criticism in the media as a benchmark for success or otherwise of our policies. So that does not mean you should not be sensitive to that. But I think some of the criticism and the reactions that relate to that criticism probably warrant that we should actually deal with this issue far much more. And so I think it would be a very long discussion. So I would suggest that I step there for it, because I actually also think perhaps my political principles would be in a better position to openly discuss this issue, whether it's here within the portfolio committee or within in parliament. I'm not sure. I don't believe currently that in our allocation of resources in the department that we should even be worried about disproportionate allocation of resources to other things at the expense of the African agenda. I really think that we have been consistent, and this is one thing that our political principals, the executive of the Department of Foreign Affairs, scrutinizes with a fine comb when we present our allocation, is exactly what resources that we do not in any way inadvertently claw back on the resources. And one of the things that we are increasingly trying to do is not resources in the form of financial resources, but resources in terms of the caliber of people that we actually prioritize for the issue of bilateral that we cannot have all kinds of strategic partners, I think it's true. And that we have got a lot of binational commissions, I think it's true. That we are struggling to service those bilateral commissions, I also think it's true. 2 points I would like to say with respect to that, having made that acceptance, is that I think the difficulty, first of all, I think it's made more serious by the fact that in reality, these capacity constraints are not just felt by the Department of Foreign Affairs. they are actually felt by other government departments, and this is an issue that keeps on cropping. The difficulty that we have is that if you look at the number of binational commissions, most of them are with African countries, and most of them is a response by us to requests from those countries. And most of them, unfortunately, define the strength of the relationship. Once you have got a binational commission with one country, they define the relationship that we have with them through the existence or otherwise of a binational commission. And that is the truth of it. Now, it's a very difficult thing to deal with in the context. So what we've tried to do is, and that is why we're trying to create all sorts of flexible mechanisms for servicing, because we're not servicing them well. And then that I would accept. But we're trying to create all sorts of mechanisms, because if we've got 40 binational commissions, all of them at ministerial level, basically means we're going to spend about 80 days in a year just for the services for our minister to service these committees, and it's not practical. So what we are now trying to do with most of them is try to make sure that we increase the gap for the ministerial oversight and far much more drive them at official level and far much more regularly. For example, the one that we signed just last week with Malawi has put even the oversight at deputy minister level. So we're trying to negotiate all those sorts of arrangements. But bearing in mind that I think there's a bit of a contradiction between what we would rationally want to do and what sometimes in an attempt to try to reach out and try to establish and position ourselves with respect to the African continent in particular. As I say, the bulk of these financial of joint commissions are with the African continent. We've spoken about, I know, Chair, that this is an issue that the committee has raised with us many times about the issue of companies and investing in the continent. And it's an issue that even in this retreat I was talking about, I think comes up, both its positive and its negative side. We had considered the point, Chair, about the Imbizo's outreach. Let me say that with respect to the training institution, the research institution, the academic institution, I actually don't think that our outreach to them is as bad as it probably was at a certain point. Because I think our research unit has organized quite a number of interactions. Our training institute, FSI, has organized quite a number of interactions. And I noted that there's an issue of how do we use the former ambassadors. And I think we have started to use that. A number of our former ambassadors are now using the department as mentors on a part-time basis. They are training at the institute, and some of them are mentoring the young people that we are recruiting into the department. We are trying to expand that. It's far much easier to use with people who have retired. The other issue I thought I should just reflect on here is that there's an instruction currently that we're working on, and this is something that we'll try to do, to basically do what other, and this will make use of experience that has been within government, whether in parliament or in the executive or former ambassadors. Many countries have got advisory panels or I'm not sure whether to call them think tanks, but it's usually, if you look at Egypt, for example, all the former, whoever was a former minister or former members were active in the portfolio committees or former ambassadors were acquitted themselves well, are part of a team that advises, that acts as some advisory organ, makes a policy, new policy initiative, are bound and discuss with that team. And we've had instructions from the minister to begin to work towards that. And that is something that we will establish also in the department in the second half of this year. So that is something I think, again, it will just broaden the pool of people who can support, give advice from a position of experience. Because part of the problem is that you do not have too deep a pool in South Africa of people already extremely familiar with what some of the underpinnings that drive the implementation and the way we look at foreign policy. I don't think we have that. So but how to improve this coordination with academic and research institutions. And that will also speak to the issue of the ISA, which I see has arisen again. The Africa Institute, we do work with the Africa Institute. There's been a discussion, as I said last year, around the Africa Institute probably coming to the Department of Foreign Affairs. There was a view, however, that also came from science and technology that at that point in time, because of the transition and some difficulties that they thought existed at the Institute, they did not think that it was wise, and we probably agreed with that, to transfer it at a time when, because they had a better understanding of what those constraints are. We have restarted those discussions again with the Department of Science and Technology. So I think it's far much more issues of timing about the transfer of the Institute, but also to define better whether the Institute on moving to the Department of Foreign Affairs will remain the way it is, or it will be considered in a slightly different way. We are equally discussing now with respect to pooling our resources on the research side between ourselves and SARS, the External Intelligence Agency, about pooling our research resources because we are duplicating effort currently. We are researching and trying to search the same issues, research the same issues. But the improvement around these interactions, and I think this is a point that we've taken to heart. And maybe I should ask Marco to talk a bit on the issues around capacity, and then I'll come back to add to whatever she might have left.
Good morning, honorable member. Didi, thank you. Let me talk to two issues around capacity that came out very strongly. All the five presenters were talking about our aggressive foreign policy agenda, but wondered whether we had the capacity within the department to be able to deliver on that. Capacity in terms of number of people, but also capacity in terms of the skills that we have within the institution. Some of the comments were made that we don't even have business chiefs and building skills, economic diplomacy skills, and so forth. Now, with regard to the SSI, there's been quite a lot of work that has been done since 2003-2004, and I think we have come to the portfolio committee a number of times to report on what is happening at the Foreign Service Institution around skills development of our officials. And we have reported that we did a restructuring of the Foreign Service Institute where we elevated it to be headed by DDG. But not only ended there, we have configured the whole institution and added some more directorates. Notably, we have a new directorate that's focusing on quality assurance, making sure that the quality of courses that we're providing at the FSI are the ones that will really develop our diplomats well. We also created another directorate that looked at research and development, working quite closely with our policy and research unit. The one on quality assurance also will be focused on making sure that the institute is accredited for whatever training that we're providing at the Foreign Service Institute, that all that training is accredited. So we added onto what we had, those two directories, and then elevated the directories that are dealing with diplomatic training and dealing with administration training. We also embarked on new programs within the Foreign Service Institute. Within the BNCs that I have seen with some countries in the continent, notably the DRC, Sudan, and Rwanda, and Maputo, or rather Mozambique, we are beginning to provide working closely with them in terms of assisting their own foreign ministries in the areas of training and development. So there is cooperation between the Foreign Service Institute with their own training establishment. Sometimes, for instance, in the DRC, they don't even have a diplomatic academy, and our work there has been to assist them to put in place a fully fledged diplomatic academy, and also providing training to their ambassadors and officers of mission. In Rwanda, for instance, we'll be looking at providing assisting them with protocol training, assisting them with language training in English. So we've started introducing programs where we are working quite closely with other countries within the continent, and this is within the structured DNC. We've looked at the content of all the courses that we have, and the main issue here being economic diplomacy. So to what extent are we picking that up? And we are involved in DTI and other departments in terms of providing those courses. We have also looked at the people that we've used over time in terms of providing the lectures, and have brought on board new people. I mean, Dr. Lansford himself is one of the major people that are providing training at the SSI. Dr. Zondi himself is also on a list of lecturers at the institute, and many others, including other people within government itself. We've also introduced a cadet program, and that talks to the broader HR training, the pipeline for young diplomats. So we currently have about 45 young people that are at the SSI, and we have developed a whole program for them together with UNISA in terms of focusing on how do the transition between having had it all at university, but diplomatic practice in particular, that transition. So we're working with UNISA on this kind of program. But there will be future capacity for the department. In fact, we are in the process of thinking how do we then select out of those 45 the one that we feel are good enough to then join the department on a permanent basis. The DJ has already talked about the monitoring program that we have within the SSI using retired ambassadors. We have focused quite strongly on expanding our language program. Issues were raised to say, if we don't know the language, how do we then get involved in some of the mediation that we do? To say, the latest program that we've put in place is French for diplomats. And there we have insisted that all the senior managers that have to deal with countries where French is the language of the spoken language, that they attend this specific course, French for diplomats. Then there are new initiatives that we are currently working on, and we'll see the finalization of those during the current financial year. The one which also was raised by Dr. Bundy, Dr. Lansford, is around how do we cooperate with the university. I think the comment that was made was that there's no single university in South Africa that is offering a degree in diplomacy. Okay, and indeed that is true. Sometime last year, the DG requested the Foreign Service Institute to explore this issue of a degree in diplomacy, a master's degree in diplomacy, for a number of reasons. One, sometimes we think the department itself will have people that are diplomats. They've been practicing diplomacy for a long time, prior learning, but not necessarily having a particular qualification, so you'll be able to cater for those people. But also there could be other people that do have, within the institution, that do have degrees which are not necessarily in diplomacy, like myself, that would probably want to consider something like this. So we have indeed engaged the various institutions, academic institutions. We went on tender, and we even had a briefing with those academic institutions to explore possibilities of using master's degree in diplomacy. I must say, we'll see how that goes. We are also with technology being a big issue now, and wanting to reach in particular our transferred officials, because if you are in the mission for 4 years, there is development, but you need to sustain that development while you are doing your profit for 4 years. How do you best do it? And you really need to take advantage of technology. And secondly, there are locally recruited people, that is the local employees of DSM in different missions. To what extent are we catering for that development as well? So we are researching an e-learning program, and we are hoping that this program will also be finalized by the end of this financial year, so that we put that in place. Other than engaging the institutions of higher learning around this master's degree in diplomacy, we have started engaging them in different workshops, as the DG was saying earlier, together, obviously, in collaboration with our research unit. So there is a number of things that are happening at the institute, there is focus on trying to address some of the gaps, and I think it's ongoing work within the institute. Now, coming to the issue of that was capacity around skills. We have the relevant skills. Now, capacity in terms of numbers, again, whenever we come here, we indicate to you what the establishment is, what the vacancies are, and all the time we do reflect the vacancies that we have, and the comment that came up was that the vacancies are really too high and not acceptable. The one thing that I can say is that we address those vacancies throughout the year, but notably twice a year we go on to what we call a recruitment drive. So we've just had our recent recruitment drive in February, where we advertised 225 positions. Now, the question that you might have is that, but if you have 400 off, why are you advertising 225? And again, it's an issue of pacing the organization to say at one point how many new people can you really absorb. And so we have advertised 225. We are in the process of filling those. Just to say, for instance, we have already made recommendations for deputy directors in line function. We have already made recommendations for deputy directors, assistant directors in line function. Out of interest, we're looking for 77 assistant directors, for instance. And during the process of identifying people that we think are good, we can only get 31. So we already know as we're sitting here that we won't get the 77 that we need. What we're able to get is 31. So it already leaves you with a gap. And we're hoping that the cadet program and other initiatives that we're making eventually will get there. I think, every year we advertise and the structured process, we are able to get who we want. We are not able to get all the numbers that we need. And I've also said to the committee in previous years that to the extent that you promote internally, it is a good thing. You are also creating vacancies. And just to say, the deputy directors that are going to be promoted now, only one is from outside. The deputy directors that are going to be appointed, there's only one from outside. So the rest are internal. So what does it do? Just create further gaps at the level below. So you have to address that, and we are already short. So it's assistant directors that have been promoted to deputy director level. But as you know, that we are already short of, we needed 77, we've got 31, and yet we've created another gap by promoting to the assistant director. So it's an ongoing thing that we really do. But just to say to you, there are other measures that we put in place to try and attract talent within DSA. There are branding activities that we're engaging in. I'm sure you've seen Foreign Affairs in Companies of the Future to Work For, the Sunday Times survey. We participate in the SABC Career Fair, where they go throughout the country to say where our potential careers with different organizations. So we very much part of it last year, and this year we're still part of the SABC Career Expo. We go religiously to the institutions of higher learning across the country. The visitors name them, all of them will go there. To then position Foreign Affairs and really invite people to be interested. And when we go there, we take some of the colleagues, like Liguyo and other like some colleagues, to go and talk about diplomacy, international relations, and encourage people to apply. We also participate in other private sector, if you like, career exhibitions. The last one that we did was in April, which was done by Gordon Institute of Business and Gifts. And there you are really exhibiting with your Tibetan truth, your fault, Alexander fault and so forth, but we are there. Because what we have realized in the research that we did with Matters Communities is that Tolmaten does tend to come to mind to young people that they have considered law, that they have considered commerce. The challenge is at what point do they decide that, yes, I've thought about foreign affairs, but you know, on second thoughts, I think I'll go to Alexander Fox and not to PhD. So we need to understand at what point do they make that decision and what influences that decision. So it's work in progress in terms of trying to attract young people into the organization. Now, the other issue that was raised was that I guess at strategic level, just to say we're in the process of closing that. We have already advertised, we are in the process of interviewing. In fact, with some data posts, we are at the stage of just making those appointments. So it's an ongoing process of trying to address the issue of capacity. And as they stated, the people that were commenting on this, it's not a problem of foreign affairs only. It's a problem of the entire public sector. But we're working in a very structured approach to try and address it.
Thanks, Martin. Just some concluding remarks from this chair. Just to say on the filling of strategic positions, for example, there are DDC positions in the department. We advertised them last year. Now, one of the questions, of course, that's a constraint that we'll have to deal with is foreign affairs in a position to appoint three new DDCs and all of them being men. Against the background of government policy now and the targets that we have set that have been approved. So we couldn't proceed, partly because of that. So there's been all sorts of things that we've been trying to do to try and address that. Also, just to say, with this thing about peacekeeping, peacemaking, we have established some sort of partnership with the Center for Conflict Resolution here. And also Accord. In fact, we've sent teams here that have come for training, and we're trying to integrate part of that program as an ongoing program now within the department. On the budget side, just three things that I thought we should indicate. There is a real, I think, a valid comment that has been raised, and I think the committee has raised it before, which was the issue around how do you link budget allocations from a monitoring perspective to the priority. And as you know, that I think all of government, we've not been good at that. But of course, it's improving now because it's a major area of focus, even for the Auditor General, around the area of performance auditing. So even in the department, we're trying to address that far much more strongly. There was an issue around the exchange rate. Just to stress again that, as the members of the committee would know, yes, the rent fluctuates, but it's of no consequence to us immediately with respect to our budget because of the agreement we have with Treasury, which is that if the rent changes significantly during the year, then during the adjustment estimate in October, because every time they allocate us a budget, there's a conversion figure that is used. If it goes up or down, all that happens is that either Treasury gives us more money or return money to the Treasury. That's how it is done. And we think currently we are comfortable with that because then we are not currency speculators ourselves because we can never know what's going to happen. There's an issue that was raised about the African Renaissance Fund, which is valid. That African Renaissance Fund up to now has tended to be used far much more for peacekeeping and conflict resolution, and that it should increasingly be used for developmental purposes. I think that is true, and in fact, probably this year we'll see a very big shift. Part of the problem is, last year the whole of the African Renaissance Fund was used for the DRC elections, nothing else. The year before that, again, it was significant, a lot of the Comoros, a lot of the DRC, and a lot of Burundi. So I think indeed we're getting to the phase where we're beginning to allocate more resources now for development-related purposes. I'm sure if we, let's say around the middle of this year, if we were to look at what the allocations would have been made from the African Renaissance Fund, it will show a significant departure
from the patents. There will still be peace and conflict resolution, but I think we're beginning to use the fund far much more in terms of the allocations now for developmental purposes. Chairperson, budget to support the AU and its organs, I've commented on that. By and large, Chairperson, I think really maybe there are some issues that the committee members want to still raise, but that's how we thought we should respond to some of the questions that were raised. But just to emphasize the point that I think in our view, there are a lot of things that we have not commented on, but we should take any pieces of advice or comments that we should really reflect on in the general conduct of our work, and we will do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. I think to this extent, we must commend your staff that was taking notes. I mean, I was listening to quite keen interest as to where, why they were sitting there. It means that they were really making sure that they write every word that is being said. You presented it as if you were actually there yourself. And that tells you the accuracy of the brief that you received. We are going to ask members if there are any other issues that they may want to follow up in that. For instance, DG, you have raised the issues of SACU, SADC, and that there is no immediate contradiction between SACU economic arrangement, trade fee area as SACU now and SADC later. If it goes to that level, and we've alluded to strategies that could be employed now of either bringing new members into SACU while working towards a SADC Y. And my assumption therefore will be that your definition of SADC will be the same as it stands now. But DG, that's not how the EU defines SADC. And the economic partnership with the EU has a bearing, one on the political integration of SADC, but also on the free economic agreement with the EU. How then do you reconcile the IPA process as defined by the EU currently and our understanding of how we want to develop the SADC community? You have raised the issues related to the accreditation of FSI courses, and which is quite an interesting development, because it is important that those who train people, they actually get accredited for going through that particular process. And of course, we leave the issues of the UN Security Council that they were raised. But DG, I did not hear you engaging much on issues of the civil society. It was raised as one of the key elements. You have raised the fact that we will see a number of individuals, but there were specific issues that were raised. How do you relate with the civic movement, specifically in this country? How do you relate with those institutes that find themselves doing international work? Where is their port of call when they pick up issues in their engagement in those fields? Where do they go to get themselves clarified on the issues? And that was raised particularly by COSATU and SANCO, to say that COSATU sits in a number of international bodies. When does it have the opportunity to come to GFA to be assisted to understand other over and above the trade union over and above their trade union engagement, but understand other issues of international relations, so that will help them to articulate certain positions correctly, or rather, that it will help them to make sure that they advance the same work that our diplomats are working. They don't find themselves working against each other. So those are the issues that I would have liked the DG to deal with. The pity that Umar Mnumpozo was out, but I wanted to deal with the issues of transfer officials and their development. because once they're in the mission, in fact, that's where you stand still until you come back home. Whether it be promotion, whether it be anything. In fact, once they're in the mission, your career comes to an end. Until you come back home, there's nothing can be done about you. I think we need to look at that. What do we do with those transfer officials? How do we get them to benefit from... I know that at some point the department came and made a presentation that we'll only get promotion when you come back home. But it means that by the time that official comes back home, and if he becomes fortunate and gets sent somewhere else, that official will have a substantial amount of time not being promoted or not growing in the organization. One issue, I'm raising this as a last issue before I open to members. You know, there's something that I picked up when I traveled to left-hand driving countries, Fiji. Our officials have raised this issue. They've raised this issue that when they come back home, they need to start afresh, looking for a car to go to work. While those who are driving in right hand, they could bring their cars home and they can proceed without a problem. Now, the question is that they've lost if they're in the left-hand driving. They've lost it. They can't bring it back because we don't use left-hand driving cars here. Yes, they are, but that's a rule. So now, DG, I'm pleading for them that there must be a consideration of helping them to settle.
Sir, can I just comment very briefly on this point of view because they are important. On the left-hand driving car, we know the problem. The problem we have is that there's a particular year that was used as a cut-off point, not by us, by SAS. We've spoken to revenue services many times. It's really an issue, and they are not budging on it. So it's a major problem. It is true, and it looks very awkward because now people start saying if you send me to a left, a car where they drive left-handed, at least my next posting must be to a right-handed. And it complicates issues around posting. So, but it's we would really appreciate the committees, if the committee could make also representation to the revenue. I mean, really, it's especially because we don't know what it is based on. Because, as I say, there's just a particular year at which they cut off. They did the changes, it was that, and they also passed a rule that affects, maybe that complaint will come to you again, but that affects people accredited to South Africa. For example, we've got many complaints of people who are accredited to South Africa who brought in cars or who bought cars, but those cars cannot be sold in the South African secondary market. So they are forced to take the cars out. Again, revenue services got some explanation for that, but it creates all sorts of difficulties for us. The issue of Kosate and Franco, let me say that up to now, really, our focus, and I must concede that this was a shortcoming on our side, was far much more to deal with the research and academic institutions. And when I said that, at least that situation has improved a bit to our research unit, because it becomes the entry point. But with Kosatu and Sanko, in fact, we've just had a discussion recently with Kosatu. We have not had any structured engagement with them. In the case of Kosatu, it's because I think what has brought it to the surface by their own admission, I think they are also developing significantly their international relations portfolio. So we've undertaken that we will have a discussion and create a forum and a mechanism for interaction between with the other structures of civil society. I take the point around the issue of promotion of transfer officials. It's a major problem. We asked HR some time back to do a detailed study on this, largely because our officers were complaining that they know that officials, for example, Nigeria, would take promotion panels to different centers and promote people while they're in the mission. Problem that we have on our side is that the posts that we can advertise are posts in head office because our public service regulation allow a certain, if you go to Brazil or to Nigeria, it is virtually unheard of that you will be promoted in the foreign ministry when you are from outside. Brazil deals only with internal promotion. In our case, a position above assistant director has to be advertised for everybody, including external people. That is the first constraint that's related to our law. The second problem is that we don't forbid officials to apply for promotion. But if we've got a position, which is a first secretary, which is assistant director in a mission, and the person wants to be promoted into a deputy director position, it is costly for us to have a deputy director abroad doing a work that should be done by an assistant director. So the person needs to make up their mind that if they get the promotion, they must be ready to come back. And now that's usually the personal difficulty that people then have. Otherwise, our fear is that we'll then end up with promotions of people outside. The way we try to correct it, as Matthew has indicated, we've got two recruitment cycles, and we tend to link those with the return of officials who are outside, because by the time people have spent 4 years, indeed they've accumulated a lot of experience, are ready for promotion. The other thing that we are trying to do now, against sometimes the wishes of some of the officials, we are trying to be stricter that people must not have back-to-back postings. Because what was also causing this, people would spend 4 years and immediately want to go to another mission. Because of the benefits at the time, it is convenient, but it affects them later on. Now we are insisting that people must come back to an office at least for a year. And during that time, we can deal with the issue of regularizing their promotions. But also we actually just think for people to have another feel of the country, because then they can represent far much better. So that's what we're playing around with now. But as you say, I think if you look at what Marco was saying, that most of the promotions that we're doing are internal, actually most of it is internal, and most of it is officials who are just returning from the mission. And it's largely a result of the fact that if you've been an assistant director for 4 years in a mission, and then now there's a deputy director position that's available, actually you just cruise into that deputy. Because you have 4 years of real experience. And for the organization, it actually becomes good, because as you send that official back next time, you're no longer sending them as a first secretary, but sending them as a counselor. So they feel also there's an issue of progression on their side. So I think what we just need to be firm on ourselves is to work against this human instinct of wanting to have back-to-back postings. Now, part of the problem that the department had is that when we were understaffed and opening a lot of missions, it was very convenient for the organizations also to just be sending people. But as we build up the capacity, given that we've got more officials in head office than outside, we are now finding that for every official who's returning, we're beginning to have an adequate pool of people who are ready to go out. And therefore, it will make that rotation far much more smoother. So I think that's how we're trying to... But as you say, it is the issue of SADC and AirPass. I do take the point, Chair. I mean, there was a meeting in Brussels just now that we were given a report on. It's a constant fight between us and the EU. We are not winning the battle, but at least we are just guided by the fact that even though there's got this differentiation, we think really the crunch time is going to come for many countries, because most of the countries agree to this division by the EU, largely because they've got no alternative. Our sense is that once we make, certainly in the case of SADC, we expand the customs unity, and that genuine benefits that accrue to those countries that have joined, in as much as that genuine benefits that accrue to Lesotho. And we become also hard on countries, let's take Swaziland, for example, which we're allowing at the present time. It's a member of SADC, it's a member of COMESA. Actually, and COMESA is beginning to be a customs union in itself. And us in SADC, we've been discussing the point that I think we need at some point to draw the line and make sure that people actually make choices about where they want to be, to belong. But our political grip is really to try to expand. But as I say, I take the point that you're making, that the efforts do complicate. It's not going to be a smooth process. And I think that's part of what we're really trying to argue with the EU. if you look at the strategic plan of action and the strategic plan we will send it that was signed yesterday with the EU, one of the points we are making in South Africa very clearly that we are building the strategic partnership with the EU on the understanding that the EU is going to work with us as strategic partners to make sure that no action of the EU negates our attempts at regional integration. And basically what we were trying to address and talk to them on is the issue of the airport. So it's an issue that I think we want to put far much more boldly on our agenda with the EU, because it is, as you say, quite divisive. Thanks.
Members?
Well, the department, I think they carry some very problematic. I don't know why there is an echo.
Yeah, they might say that someone comes from a rural area.
That's where life is. I don't know. Maybe proximity of these things. Yeah, well, that's not a... You didn't send in your postal vote, you're to blame. So that I'm saying it has problems. One begins to think that perhaps there should be a plan. These are realities. For instance, if you think of the staff, as you're saying, unending vacancies, the two should be studied and put together. What plan can be implemented to overcome this unending vacancies, because you promote, like you ably said, you promote and create gaps, and the intake is far lower than the promotions. I think there needs to be some study made around that problem. How can it be, you know, overcome? And attached to that, another thing that needs to be studied is how much do we retain this intake, how long does it stay with us? I think it's also a problem there. And if they stay longer, when they go out, what do we do with them? Because there must be some mobility, almost like manipulated mobility. After some period, people have to move, new intakes. And our outreach program to the institutions, facilities, can't we be innovative at times, like during vacation, encourage students just to have the feel of what foreign affairs does, to serve, but it must be a monitored process. You don't leave them when they're out. You keep on trying to follow them to see perhaps they've gained interest, and if they're gaining interest, what more should be done? Yeah. I guess that's about my comment. Oh, one other thing, the conundrum about the gender, I want to say gender cultures or that representativity. If there is a post that is critical and you don't get the right kind of gender, should it just be left like that? Or it's a matter of saying, hearers needed skills. The needed skills here are they. And what do we do? All of us, all and sundry, both genders. It's for the country. What do we do? Do we keep it open until some little daughter or some little boy is born? Or do we go on with what we have to continue with the important work that we do in foreign countries? Thank you.
The chairman just asked me to just hold on the fort. I know the other strategy is for me not to talk. Ruth here will be the next one.
Okay, thank you, Acting Chair. I just wanted to ask the DG, in relation to NEPAD, he kept to referring to IGR meeting or summit. Can you be so kind when he sends us some documents, maybe to send us the latest decisions in relation to the development in Nepal? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson.
DG Minor will comment with only two. The first one, Umama, tried to address this issue among vacancies. But the way it was presented to us, it raised some eyebrows as if there are not vacancies. I think in future it will be very much better if we can be directed that to be given statistics that we are having so much vacancies and we have occupied so much vacancies. Because the way they put that issue, it was very, very, yeah. And now the second one, DG, I'm a little concerned about the issue of Swaziland. I can recall when COSATU raised the issue of Swaziland. And it means that, I know that when that South Africa is doing something about Swaziland, but the way they presented it about Swaziland, they've made some examples. For example, the first one, that during the workers' day, there were a lot of activities. To an extent, a lot of people were arrested. Some were even shanked off and alive. There was nothing which was said about Swaziland. But even the media itself covered the Zimbabwe and other countries. I mean, except Swaziland. Therefore, I would be very much grateful if maybe the DG can maybe say something about it. Because I recall very well, even some time before, we also raised the very same issue and the DG tried to respond on that one. And also, there is another one which I'd like to bring to your attention, DG, to an extent. Internal, here in South Africa, the people of Swaziland who are refugees here, they are very much, I mean, concerned about some the way they were treated here. But I'll leave it like that because it's still embargoed some of these things. I'll read with the chair paper. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DG. Actually, I think the interaction is that the input can be so good that it's actually pre-thought a lot of the issues that we were actually discussing, a lot of the issues that became problematic with us. You know, that was going to raise in the department after the, you know, the public hearing. And I think you very, very, you know, efficiently covered that. So, in fact, the family and family got the rest. What Numa is going to be called. The is a steppy fire, like you said. She's all right now. So, thank you very much. Now, though, you know, reception. I think there is a problem about South Africa playing this role of leadership, you know, in the continent. I think it brings, you outlined it. I think it brings a lot of problems for the department. In fact, even when I think I can take it back to when we were in exile. Anyway, South Africa used to be seen, you know, as South Africans used to be shaking mud, being seen in a particular way, and defined in a particular way. But I think that it's an issue where really the DFA will just have to sit down and really take a firm decision on how you are going to, you know, to handle that one. I feel myself that for many reasons, you know, South Africa really is already in that leadership role. And it's a recognition, and it's a fact, and we must decide how bold we want to, you know, to take that role forward. Perhaps we can look at you know, other nations which found themselves in a similar situation. How should they overcome these sensitive problems that we're talking about without, of course, looking like Big Brother colonizing and all that kind of thing? But it's an area that needs to be looked into and some decisions taken. Other matter is the one of which has come up. Is the one of we talked about it, you know, a little bit about the interaction between the department and the many, many people now that leave the country, either in their capacity in BIPOC or representing an organization, you know, or those organizations can be churches, it can be any organization, you know, and going out there and having to make, you know, utterances to the people out there which have got foreign international affairs ramifications, which are related, you know, to foreign affairs. How do you get a grip on that? How do you get, you know, somehow to, you know, to get a grip on that so that you don't get this everybody saying what you know those guys say. And then of course the media will jump on what they want, you know, to take out of that situation where there is no way even to go through some gates. Some gateway, you know, to be able to talk on international affairs when they are outside of the organization. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you very much. Let me start with the. Let me so that because both Mr. Saramane raised actually the issue around the gender. I agree. Maybe I presented it wrongly. I don't want to argue that because we have that concern, we will not feel the position. All that I'm just alluding to is that it does cause the delay, because the truth of the matter, having advertised, if you did not get something that will help promote gender, the next obligation you have is to go to some post of head hunting. All I'm saying is that then there's a gap between the time when the position was advertised, when that vacancy existed. And indeed, there's a point at which you'll find that if you're not getting the suitable position, you might have to take certain decisions in order to ensure continuity. So just to say that. I think the idea, we must take it out, because I actually think it's not something we've thought about. This one of using during vacations and taking some people into the department. I actually think, particularly when we get to the stage, hopefully, where we've got better facilities and working in the same building, I think it will be something that we can easily probably manage. But I think it will be good as part of the start we'll deal with that. I will send the document on the Algiers matrix. You know, the last point that we're making, Honorable Mamatuli, is that indeed it's a big problem. You know, the team that we are, that is why we're trying to bring all these entities on the 4th of June. Because we're trying to say, what is it that we can do that is not too mechanical? But at the same time, maybe it starts with a common understanding. Do South Africans understand that what they say outside the country sometimes has a major impact and can negatively affect the country? So it's not even a question of trying to manage people, but it's just to make sure that all of us must act in a manner that promotes our country, or at least we must be sensitive to. So part of this discussion on the 4th, we're trying to find a way of coordinating this within government and also with other structures of civil society that is not too restrictive, but at the same time facilitates, that allows the information. I mean, we still have weaknesses now, even where delegations from, particularly from local government, with the growing involvement of local government, even within the government sphere, where people go to a place and then you find that given the let's say go to China, because China has been a major area now, too many delegations going to China, but find that people don't even have very basic understanding of our base of our interaction with China. Sometimes people make mistakes, not knowing the sensitivities around China and the issues of Taiwan, all sorts of things like those. So I think, but as I say, we're starting, which is why we want to do it a bit. We've got some ideas, but we want to do it in a far much more consultative way, because we want it to be something that people don't feel that it's too bureaucratic and stifling, because the intention is to facilitate, but at the same time make sure that we I also take the point, I think it's a big problem. Maybe we have the dilemma on this leadership is in the continent, that maybe it was unavoidable that we'll go through a stage where we're far much more cautious. Maybe as we feel confident that we have established our bona fides in the continent and people see that we've got a positive, maybe we'll accept. But also I think one of the encouraging things, as I was saying, I think one of the encouraging things that I got from this retreat of ministers is to see people who are not South African having the courage to raise issues that actually in the past people would be cagey about. Basically to ask the question and say, but what, if people are suspicious of South Africa, what is the basis for the suspicion? Because in practice and in reality, South Africa is doing everything that should actually make us feel far much more easy. So I think maybe it's also beginning to come out far much better, and it is raised also by other people, as opposed to being South Africa that is actually. But I think it's a really difficult issue. Honourable member, I know you raised the point even when we met on Swaziland. This is one issue that we have discussed with COSATU incidentally. You know that on the 12th, and COSATU was going to have roadblocks at some point on the border. Swaziland approached us formally that they have this problem. We discussed with Swaziland, but part of the discussion we always have difficulty with, even our own discussion at government level with Swaziland, is to impress upon them that there are certain things that constitutionally in South Africa are permissible and that the government cannot obstruct. And we define what the limits of those are. But sometimes there's an expectation on their side that we should be doing things that would run contrary to our own constitutional dispensation. But maybe there are also other discussions currently that we are having with Swaziland. I don't know how to handle them. Maybe at some point I must discuss with the chairperson and maybe give some sort of insight, and then the chairperson can see, because I know these meetings tend to be open to the media also. Maybe just for us to talk a bit about what is it concretely that we're doing with Swaziland. Because remember also that part of our sensitivity is that you remember the time when the president was going to go to Swaziland.
And that's off the record.
Yes.
What you are going to say now.
Yes. Okay. because when the president at some point was going to go to Swaziland, all it needed was that to leak. And the instinctive reaction from the side of Swaziland was for all those around the king to say, no, we cannot have a presentation that creates an impression that the president of South Africa is coming to tell the king what to do. And that's how that trip was called off. So even the issues around how you respond, how we deal with them, become very sensitive issues. But indeed, there are quite a few discussions that are taking place. With Swaziland, it's our own perspective on what we think that the route that they should be taking. But that's as far as I can go for now. I think that is those are the issues. I think the issues around, we've spoken about the issues around the vacancies. And as I say, I think maybe the way we should look at the vacancies is that we are uncomfortable about the vacancies, but there's a part of us that we've got about 300 or so vacancies, about 400 vacancies in the department. The truth of it is that even if we had 400 eligible people, we would not take them. Because first of all, we don't know where to house them. Secondly, we think the organization is not ready to take all those people. But we've kept that figure because that is a figure that comes out of a detailed study that shows what should be the capacity of foreign affairs that allows foreign affairs to discharge this mandate. So we are incrementally building on that. But the other issues around concerns about retention, I think our state are trying to do a lot of things. Problem is, as I said the previous time, is that some of these laws is good for us to an extent. For example, we had to have 3 good deputy directors this year. 2 of them I was approached by the relevant minister. They are going to other departments to have a good example. Is one who's going to sport, I can say. Is the deputy director is promoted, is going to director position to have their international relations in sport. Truth of the matter, the part of that is good for the department from a point of coordination. Other countries like Brazil, for example, international units in every ministry are headed by people who are seconded by the foreign ministry, which facilitate their coordination. We are not there yet. So some of those losses, and you always have this contradiction, do you lie and say this is not a good official because we want to keep them, or you must be truthful and let the person go? But in these cases, as I say, you then... So we've got losses like those that hit us, but you know, in the broader scheme of things, it's not a bad thing in order to promote coordination within government. Then we've got an issue that I raised before, that just the growing marketability. The truth of it is that some of these, we had somebody who was kept as a deputy, there was a deputy director in Washington. Upon return, I think he still wanted to stay in DFA. But the truth of the matter, the money that Anglo-American was giving him, it's just not possible to stay. It's not even possible for us to begin to think about, you know, retaining the person. And so people make those choices. As I said, we've got, especially for the key emerging markets now, China, India, our attrition there, we try to put the safeguards that we can. But people sometimes stay only the mandatory period precisely because the companies in South Africa are keen to get those officials over those insights from those places. It's even worse now. For example, we started putting people through the Mandarin program, and truth of the matter, we know those officials will probably come back and just stay the mandatory period that they have. And the attraction and the attractiveness to the private sector is going to be very, very huge. Because simultaneously as we expand our interaction with the South African private sector is also going in a big way. You know that we just lost one of our divisions to MTN. He's heading the international divisions of MTN. Now, if you look at what MTN is putting on the table, it's just difficult to even begin to think. So I think there are those realities that we have to deal with from the attrition side of things. However, I think within reason, in terms of what is possible, I think we're trying to deal with the retention thing, try to keep the pace, encouraging, increase the levels of exposure. But as I say, there are certain limits. We can push from the academic institutions. But the private sector becomes a big problem for us.
Thank you, DG. We've been complaining about the big South African business in the continent. Maybe if people move to these organizations, we'll see a change of behavior on one hand. So. It's a give and take arrangement. We lose people at departments. But if those people stay within the country, we hope that wherever they are, they will then make sure that those organizations are led in a particular way that they will advance our foreign policy. And that, of course, that will then increase South Africa's foreign policy articulators more than we have now. DG, there's one issue that I wanted to raise for some time. You know, as you say that we are taking people in every time, the age of the department is going down. The department is becoming younger and younger and younger. In doing so, you have spouses of these young officials who are also deployed outside. You can't be sitting with a 20, 25-year-old young spouse idly, whether it's a male or it's a female. I think we need to just give a thought how we deal with that, because the more we deploy our people, we deploy them young, they are starting families, they are building families, and of course we need to find a way, because the spouse there cannot be employed. Maybe we need to find a way to how creatively we grow them, because when the spouse comes back after 4 years, and he or she is not marketable, that's why then you want to see an official wants a back-to-back deployment, because then he can't cope, he can't survive. And sitting with a spouse that is not marketable and has been sitting in a particular country for 4 years. We need to find a way how we advocate myself says that we have lacking. But we need to find a way how we assist both at the level of counseling, because sometimes we may not be able to give them resources, but how do we assist these young couples to make certain decisions for long term, for their family to grow in the long term, not in the short term of being excited that I'm going. Remember that we have not, particularly applicants, we have not traveled. So an opportunity to travel, an opportunity to stay in another country, being a young person is quite exciting, but it has its own problems later. So if maybe we can assist these young people to make correct decisions as to how, when they are deployed there, how do they deal with their situation. So when they come back, at least and the other partner should be marketable, in the market, be able to survive. The last issue, PT, that I'll probably not stop raising, and our diplomats, I do not think and I do not believe, I've raised that with the Deputy Minister Sue von der Merwe, and she believes that we are doing this fantastically. I do not believe that we are giving our diplomats sufficient and efficient means to survive as individuals. Outside their normal work and whatever they get at work. After the age of our diplomatic corps is going, it's becoming young. So if you have a diploma that's going to raise a child that's going to go to university next year, we don't pay for that, did you? We don't pay for that. Now, how do we create a better life, did you? If we don't pay for that kid. I believe that as part of their sacrifice to be out of the country, they need to get the benefit. Even if we don't pay the full fee, but we need to pay something. This thing of saying that, no, bro, your kid now is in the university, we wash our hands, I don't think it's a correct policy. I think we need to come back and say yes. I'm raising this because it has become a very serious issue from 1 year here in Parliament when we told you to cut down the number of dependents on our travelling. It became a very nasty issue. So I'm looking at that young man and I'm saying to myself, if his kid is going to university, he has to send that kid back home. Because he can't afford, he's sitting probably in Brazil. The fees there are higher, he cannot afford. He cannot afford to take the kid, he must send the kid, and the kid is about 18, 19 years. First year university, all the excitement of university under no control of parents. The parents are thousands of kilometers away from him or her. We are going to have disaster. I'm pleading for them to say, we need to look at how we assist those diplomats. Even if you don't pay the full fee,